The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show with me, Charles Christian. Thank you for tuning in again. So, no more chatting from me this week, as we've a very full show with not one but two interviews. First up, we're talking to writer and editor John Linwood Grant about the occult detective fiction genre. John is the editor of Occult Detective magazine, very good it is too, I read it, and edits various anthologies, including the Sherlock Holmes and the Occult Detective series for Bellinger Books. A further collection of John's weird fiction called Where All Is Night and Starless will be out from next year. John says he has a beard and he describes himself as aging and sarcastic. I think sarcasm comes with aging, actually. And it's my great pleasure to be talking to John Linwood Grant. Hello, John.
Hi there.
Right. Now, we're talking about occult detective fiction. Now, we've got plenty of people on this show who come along who are paranormal investigators, but this is the fiction side of things, and it's a whole different genre. For the benefit of people who aren't familiar with it, because it is a bit of a niche, just explain what it's about.
Well, good question. I suppose basically we're talking about something that goes back into the 19th century. That was where it was really all formed. And some people see it as a subgenre of horror, or paranormal fiction and those areas. But basically, it has a certain number of aspects of its own. And the side that we tend to focus on, or I focus on when writing, and we focus on when editing and publishing, is the insistence that, A, there has to be an investigator.
Mm-hmm.
You may have to be patient with me here because it does need explaining. and by investigator, in the old days, one often had the amateur sleuth.
Yes.
Or the amateur psychic. But the whole subgenre was built very much over a century and more. And essentially, we look for an investigator who, of their own will, chooses to look into something occult, supernatural, psychic, paranormal. And they can be virtually anything. As I say, classically, they were often an amateur.
Mm-hmm.
You can think back to, think back to Sherlock Holmes, the consulting detective, although he didn't deal with supernatural. But he was part of the model for many writers.
Mm.
And you can then have what's been added in a sense over the decades, things like the police, formal investigators, actual detectives drawn into supernatural issues, paranormal issues from their normal, working beat or working set of cases. You have religious figures, vicars, priests of any religion, people who have parishioners or part of their congregation who come to them and say something's wrong, and we know the sort of classic interpretation of exorcisms and things from the films. So your occult detective could in fact be a someone from a religious body. They could be scientific paranormal investigators, those who are basically seeing this as an issue which is science beyond our science, and therefore rely on the little handheld beeping gadgets, magnetic measuring magnetic fields, and you'll be familiar with the idea of temperature drops and localized phenomena, which, you know, some would say, well, it's all a set of electromagnetic things.
Yeah.
And then there are the psychologists, occult detectives who are psychologists, who basically see this as an interaction of something outside the human, normal human experience, or something which has happened within the human brain at some point in their lives, and therefore you're looking at issues of trauma and manifestation, false phenomena, false memory, all sorts of stuff like that, you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So that was a long answer.
No, not at all. No, I mean, interesting you mentioned Sherlock Holmes, because, of course, the Hound of the Baskervilles has almost a supernatural element, although it's revealed at the end that it's just a dog with phosphorus or something on its face, but there's an element of it in there.
Oh, he touches it on it a few times, but then says that there's a misunderstanding about Holmes and Arthur Conan Doyle's writing, in that people say that Holmes, you know, completely dismissed the supernatural. Well, Holmes doesn't actually. What he technically says is that it's not his area.
Yeah.
It's not the object of this agency or his work, and as it's outside normal logic,
yeah,
he sees it's outside normal logic, he therefore doesn't give it credence. He doesn't deal with it.
Yeah.
So it's you could say it's splitting hairs, but it isn't. Basically, he isolates himself from any acceptance of the paranormal. He doesn't say it cannot exist.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that's not my job.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. No, that's fair enough. And, you know, you were talking about the 19th century people, characters who were doing it, and you've got people like Flaxman Lowe and Carnacki, the Ghost Finder and things, which some of them are really quite terrible books to try and read nowadays because their language is so stilted. But, I mean, the trend still continues because, I mean, would you rate the Ben Aaronovitch Rivers of London as falling into that category?
Yes, you probably would. And there's the, who was it, Jim Butcher's Harry Dresden.
Yeah.
Mike Carey has a series of Felix Castor. There are the spin-offs from the comic creation Constantine.
Yeah.
All sorts of things. I mean, it's quite active nowadays, and it spills over into urban fantasy, into magical realism, into stranger aspects of some detective thriller novels. There's the, who was it, Alan Rickman, Mary Lee Watkins, who they made some television shows of. I think she's an Anglican.
Yeah.
Anglican figure who basically pursues or looks at, whether she wants to or not, incidents which don't seem to make sense in other fashions.
Mm-hmm.
Around the Holmes time, it was the sort of 1880s, 1890s particularly, you had the divergence really started. You can include Stoker's Van Helsing, Professor Van Helsing.
Yep.
From Dracula. There's Dr. Hesalius. All sorts of things. But the,
is that Sheridan Le Fanu?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
That's it. And the anchor stone, which we use a lot, or the anchor figure, is in fact the one you mentioned, Carnacki.
Yeah.
Carnacki's of particular interest to me, and I've written a number of things relating to that, both fictional and non-fictional, because Hope Hodgson created what you might call the first true occult detective.
Right. Tell me more. Yeah.
Yeah, by that I mean that he was open to the concept of occult occurrences, of the paranormal and the psychic, but he employed detecting methods.
Right.
Rather than putting his fingers to his forehead and trying to see if he could conceptualize anything.
Yes.
He actually used cameras, hairs and devices across doorways. He sought to distinguish between fakery and deliberate con artists, accidents and just mistakes of perception, and genuine paranormal activities or entities. So he's the first true blend of the psychic and spiritualist background of the Victorian period, that huge upsurge of spiritualism.
Yes.
In the mid to late Victorian period. And the new concepts, really, of photographic evidence and methodically collecting details without coming to a conclusion first.
Yes.
If you get what I mean.
Yeah.
Therefore, he stands alone from, well, basically 1910, late Edwardian period to 1910. He stands alone as the fusion of the two fields, the world of developing forensic science, you might say, and the world of spiritualism and paranormal interests.
Yeah.
And that's his key role.
Yeah, right. I must admit, with some of them, I find some of his gadgets a bit, I was going to say implausible. We're talking about an implausible topic, but he's got his electrical pentacle or something and various things.
Yeah.
Some of them are a bit sort of, what? Where did that come from? But
absolutely, but they're employing new sciences.
Yes, yeah.
You're on the edge of different and imaginative uses of electricity, issues around X-rays and unseen radiations, which would later become part of the canon of physics.
Yeah.
And again, going back to what I was saying, that's why he stands out as somewhat different. It was the first attempt to fuse properly and deliberately to fuse the two sides.
With yourself, I know you write your own stories and you also edit and produce the Occult Detective Quarterly magazine. What was your interest? What drew you to it? Of all the genre of fiction it's possible to write for, what drew you to this particular niche?
Partly an interest in William Herb Hodgson.
Oh, right.
Myself and my late friend Sam Gafford, who was a Hodgson enthusiast and scholar in America, we both had a fascination with William Herb Hodgson's work, of which Carnacki is only one small aspect.
Yes.
Hodgson wrote some very strange books, one or two of which are almost unreadable. Some of which are quite astounding for the period.
Yes.
And
I mean, the House on the Borderland, that's one of his, isn't it?
Yes.
And
I
mean, that's really H.P. Lovecraft type mythical horror, but 10 years ahead of not longer than H.P. Lovecraft.
Absolutely. And it's not a lot of biographical detail remains of William Herb Hodgson, but most of his correspondence has been lost, for example.
Yeah,
but it's very curious that this chap, an unlikely chap, an ex-seaman who was into physical instruction training and things like this, came up with ideas which make him what I call the uncle of weird fiction, as you say, pre-Lovecraft. And it's most peculiar what he did. His monumental work, The Nightland, is quite astounding. No one's ever written anything like it. And the only terrible thing is that Hodgson at the time chose to write it in a faux 17th, 18th century style, makes it terribly difficult to get through. But the concepts within there were amazing. And to have this, you know, this British guy who was at one point running a physical instruction college in Blackburn, I believe, son of a minor cleric of no particular importance, came up with this astounding range of things: ghost pirates, boats of the Glencarrig, as you say, the House on the Borderland, the Nightland, And then all his Carnacki short stories. And he wasn't part of the great literary circle. A lot of the others, Conan Doyle and Wells, Jerome K. Jerome, Barry, a lot of the writers at that time, H.G. Wells, were known to each other.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them even played cricket together. But Hodgson wasn't.
Yeah.
Hodgson wasn't one of those. So how this happened, we have no idea. Anyway, Sam and I were very interested in this, and I started some time ago. I didn't want to write pastiche work particularly.
Yeah.
I started writing a cycle of stories called The Last Edwardian, which started with Carnacki's death.
Right.
I didn't particularly want to reuse Hodgson's character.
Yeah.
And I built an alternate late Victorian and early Edwardian sort of series.
Yeah.
Which is I call it Murder, Madness, and the Supernatural. And it includes the bizarrities of life at that time, society, huge changes, the asylums, it was the rise of psychoanalysis, Freud and Jung, hugely influential period, the rise of enormous scientific changes, running up to the impact on the whole of society, of course, of World War One.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing time to write about. And then so I set about that, met Sam. We discussed Hodgson, and of course we discussed Carnacki very much. And we both agreed that as we were ploughing parallel furrows, we would work together more. And one of the things that came out of that was Occult Detective magazine.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a magazine which focused specifically on exploring. And I have to say exploring very clearly, because we look for all possible interpretations of the occult detective idea. And, well, I mean, do you want me to give you a very quick example or two?
Yes, indeed. Please do.
Yeah. I mean, we have a chap in America called Brandon Barrows, a Vermontian, who writes a Japanese Shinto-based priest,
right,
who operates in Japan. We have stories set in Africa, one in a previous issue about an old female witch hunter, witch sniffer, among the villagers.
Yeah.
We've gone from we had a Roman one set in the Roman period in Alexandria, with a reluctant centurion investigating something strange in Egyptian society, right up to modern noir, dark fantasy, dark paranormal, that sort of thing. So there's an enormous amount to explore. It isn't all stuck in the... We still run amateur sleuths set in late Victorian, early Edwardian period as well.
Yeah.
Especially if they're a little different and a little curious. So it's fascinating.
Yeah, because you, as well as editing the magazine, you also write stories yourself. And one of your characters, she's a voodoo priest, am I?
Oh, careful. Hoodoo.
Hoodoo. Oh, right. Yes, I must get them right. Yeah, hoodoo, voodoo, and there's a voodoo that's a V-O-U-D-O. Yes.
Yeah, it's a big issue for her. Mama Lucy, yes. She's 1920s America.
Mm-hmm.
An old black woman who walks the eastern seaboard of America, going from community to community. But she's the reason I jumped was that the hoodoo tradition is a curious one, and it's usually linked to Protestantism.
Right.
The Baptist churches and folklore magic.
Right.
Including some Native American practices, with some synthesis of medieval European folk and herb lore.
Yeah.
And that's as opposed to the religious side of voodoo, which is sort of syncreted with Catholicism.
Yes. Yeah.
So actually one of the differences is the religious route. They both have roots with Christianity, but with different parts of it.
Yes. Right.
If that makes sense.
It does. It does. It does. Yes. Yes.
So she's a hoodoo woman, a conjure woman, a root worker.
Right.
She operates in a time. A lot of her work is hoodoo and psychology, but she operates in a time of the Jim Crow laws and dreadful inequalities and mistreatments in 1920s America.
Hmm.
And so she's part of that scene. I tie it quite closely to the. A lot of my work is tied to historical events.
Right, yes.
And historical circumstances, rather than just going off on one, as it were.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why did you go for a character like her? Apart from the obvious one that nobody else had got her. 1920s.
Well, it really comes from my interest in folk magic.
Right, yeah.
And in the tradition, which I've done a few English stories about it as well, nothing to do with Mamma Lucy, is the concept of the cunning folk.
Yes.
I don't know whether you've heard of the idea.
Cunning Murrell, the guy in Essex in the same time we're talking about, isn't it? The 19th century, early 20th century.
Mm. The Europe had its own tradition of... folk magic, of small magic, and there are lots of different words for it. Hedge wizards is one. And they were also the... Mamma Lucy's saying is, ain't no witch, because people say get the wrong idea. One of the things about the European tradition is that the cunning folk, the small law holders, were actually often used or asked to remove witch curses... or, you know, imagined witch curses, plagues, illnesses, and misfortune. They were often Christian, but of course weren't in the traditional or formal aspects of the church. So they used small magics, charms, herbs, etc., on behalf of the community or on individuals in the community. And you might call some of them operated effectively as anti-witches, you know.
Yes, indeed,
If your cow was sick, you went to one of the cunning folk to find out who'd done it and how you could put it right.
Yeah.
And this goes back into what I said about hoodoo, which is a very similar, it's an operation of small magics which is very much belongs to the people, to the community. And... often to the oppressed rather than the oppressors, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So I followed this through and sort of tracked a lot. They've got various names for them in medieval Italy, all over the European countries. And then, of course, this developed in the diaspora after slavery among black communities in America.
Yeah.
And it spread. It interlinked also with... other folk communities, including white people, poor white people of the Appalachian Mountains and things like that. So hoodoo became quite blended in some ways, although it is predominantly a black practice. It's flowed. It's been organic.
Yes.
And there are still many practitioners today. And as you can imagine, I found all this absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And because I have a big interest in history, I made a 10-year jump beyond the Edwardian stuff I was doing and thought I'd explore hoodoo and the localized communities and their issues and problems in the 20s. And because I'm old, I'm in my 60s, the first character who flowed to me was an old woman walking the roads and the dusty lanes.
Yeah.
Seeing what she could do. And Mamma Lucy was suddenly full formed.
Oh, I like that. Yes. Yes, you have that image. Yes. That's brilliant.
And I wouldn't normally write a main black character in that way. I wouldn't do it in contemporary terms because it's not me. I don't know enough about it.
Yeah.
And there are lots of sensitivities about misrepresenting other people's cultures. But I drew on, I deliberately drew on black writings about hoodoo and on period books, rather than do some sort of try and invent some flashy flashy reversion of it.
Yes.
And so I looked at the source material, and that all fitted really nicely. And so I decided, yes, I think this is worth a go.
That's brilliant. So for somebody who is wanting to get into occult detective fiction, what would be a good starting point, other than obviously subscribing to your magazine, which...
I don't need to be self-serving, but if you want to look at the range of occult detectives and when and where and how they might work, I'm afraid to say the magazine is the best source, because as I mentioned, we pick out writers who explore different approaches.
Yes.
So you'll find both classics and new interpretations in there, and lots of diversity.
Yeah.
But I would certainly say if you want to follow up on what we were saying earlier, above all else, read there's a single collection easily available and cheaply available of Carnacki the Ghost Finder.
Right.
Which will give you a nice idea, because some of his cases turn out to be hoaxes.
Yeah.
And some of them turned out to be very nasty. So yeah. You also get that nice interplay of, you know, you don't believe anything or everything. So that's quite good. Those are the best starters in many ways. There are so many others. We have an Occult Detective Magazine group on Facebook, which is easy to join. Mm-hmm. And people mention different things they've found there. If you like the traditional sort of thing, I've just edited and had published two volumes of Sherlock Holmes and the Occult Detectives, which was great fun, because in that we asked writers to pair Holmes up, the canonical proper Holmes, to pair him up with a range of invented and existing fictional occult detectives.
Right. So instead of Holmes and Watson, it's Holmes and Carnacki, or the equivalent of.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And that was great fun, because, again, in a number of those, he retains his cynicism. In a number of them, he reluctantly accepts there may be something he doesn't understand, and in a few he looks the other way as long as the result is achieved. But there are 21 stories in those volumes, and they introduce you to basically 21 different other occult detectives. So I'm thinking of things which will give you a range of ideas.
So
those are all good.
And as we've mentioned, there's The Rivers of London for more contemporary.
And Mike Carey.
Mike Carey.
Mike Carey's Carey, his Felix Castor series.
Right.
Is again a more modern occult detective.
Graphic novels, really, is Constantine, isn't it?
Constantine, yes. There are quite a few which have been developed through the comics. Comic side and become characters. There's so many, really. You mentioned Flaxman Lowe. By Hesketh Pritchard, Ian H. Heron, when he wrote with his mother. Those can be fun. Some of them are ludicrous. In the sense that you read them and you think, well, I enjoyed that, but that really couldn't have happened. That doesn't work. And some of them are quite good little stories.
So again,
they're easily available. A lot of the period stuff can be just found on Project Gutenberg. Free to download, or there are very, very cheaply purchased ebooks of a lot of these. Flaxman Lowe is fun. If you want a bit of a change, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of occult detectives. One of the things, when we pulled this together and said, let's boost it all, do the magazine, talk about it, and do blog posts and interviews, there are more than people think. They've just passed by. So it's a very lively, subgenre going all the way through. And occasionally drifts into real life. I have nothing to do with actual paranormal investigators, but of course a number of the stories we get are very serious ones about paranormal investigators, the ones I dub doomed meddlers.
Yes.
Who end up going into something, it's almost the old trope of, you know, going into the abandoned asylum or
yes.
hospital
yeah.
or the mansion on the hill or the caves and
yeah.
realizing you're dealing with something that you can't deal with.
Yes. Yes.
Run away.
Yes. Right. Well, that was brilliant. Thank you ever so much for your time, John. And, you know, good luck with your projects in the future.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about John Linwood Grant by checking out his website, www.greydogtales.com. You can also see his Amazon authors page, which is John Linwood Grant. And it's worth checking out the Occult Detective magazine group on Facebook. Now for our second interview, which is about what can best be described as silly psychic powers. We often hear of people on this show claiming to have had cosmic paranormal experiences, but for most people, it's just small things, little snaps of apparently pointless deja vu, or, as our next guest calls it, echoes from the future. As to who our guest is, because she works in education, she asked to remain anonymous to avoid pesky school kids from trolling her. So we'll just call her Miss Q.
I've had slightly strange things happen to me throughout my life, and I think, as I mentioned to you and when I wrote to you, a lot of the time it's inconsequential, there's no rhyme or reason to it, and quite often I think, what was the point of that? That to me seems like quite an interesting thing to happen, almost like efforts coming from somewhere, from either from me and my subconscious or from an external force. And you think, why? It doesn't benefit me, or sometimes you can see a slight benefit to it, but really it's bewildering to me. I often hear about people who have actual psychic abilities and you think to yourself, gosh, that's actually really beneficial, that's useful. That's something that can predict the future, can avoid a tragedy, or can at least bring some kind of peace to mm-hmm. a relative who's lost a loved one. But sometimes these really extraordinary things just happen to ordinary people like me, and it just leaves you wondering, what is it all about? What is the bigger picture? There's definitely more to life than walking around in a meat suit and then you die. There has to be. And we've only got our own perceptions to work with, and they're unique to every one of us. So if you're going to believe one person, that has to be yourself. You can have people tell you, oh, I had this terrific experience, I saw a ghost. And most of the time you think, oh, that's a really nice story. But it didn't happen to you, so you can't know how real it was.
Yeah.
For me, really stupid things seemed to happen when I was younger. I can't remember anything strange happening before I kind of hit my teens. That mm-hmm. was probably the time where either it started happening or I was becoming self-aware enough to realize it was happening. So one I can remember was just being at school at lunchtime, myself and some friends, we would go back to one of our friends' houses because it was really nearby. And we'd go up into his attic room. So it'd be like five of us. We'd go up there, have lunch, put music on, maybe even play a video game or two. And that was a way of relaxing. So one day we were all up there, and we thought, right, okay, better get back down, get back in time for the bell. And we climbed down the ladder one by one. And I burst out laughing because our friend Cammy, whose name was Cameron, Cammy fell off the ladder, landed flat on his back, And it was absolutely hilarious. So I burst out laughing and I turned around and everybody was just standing looking at me and as if, what? And I was like, what? Cammy fell off the... And Cammy was falling off the ladder at that moment that I was saying, Cammy fell off the ladder. So it hadn't actually happened yet. Ooh, it was yes. It was like a second or two maximum.
Mm.
Just seeing something as a slight blip in the future. He was fine. There was no lasting injuries. it wasn't long enough of a gap for him to have heard me say that and, you know, deliberately thrown himself off the ladder. Why would you? But, you know, that's not how it happened. And I just thought that was embarrassing because as a teenager, you don't want your friends thinking you're weird. More of a freak than you already are.
Yes.
So,
yes.
It was little things like that. And you just think, why?
Yes.
You know, that doesn't benefit us, you know.
I was going to say, it was sort of like pointless because you couldn't have warned him in advance saying, Tammy, you're going to fall off the ladder. Because he was already doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just thought, well,
what's the benefit of that psychic ability?
No, there really is none.
Yeah. So moving forward.
There was a point where I think it was a really liminal time. There were a lot of changes taking place in my life. I had just come out of a long-term relationship and had bought a place on my own. And it was stressful. It was difficult. It felt really unsettled. And my cat was really ill. I knew my cat was about to die. So it was a horrendous time. And I don't usually feel that desperate, but I felt incredibly alone. And I was really questioning, why bother trying? You know, what's life all about? It just seems to be all misery, doom and gloom. And I couldn't ever see myself being happy again. So while I wasn't quite, you know, suicidal, I really felt like this is the lowest I've ever been in my life. And I did something that I've never done before. I actually sobbed my heart out so much and spoke out loud. And I don't know who I was speaking to, God, the cosmos, anybody that was listening.
Mm-hmm.
And I just said, please, if it's going to get better, I need a sign. I need something to reassure me that this feeling is not going to continue. And I had this sort of clamshell old-fashioned phone. You'll remember the type.
Mm.
Didn't do very much. Certainly wasn't a smartphone.
Nope.
All of a sudden, this tune came from it. And I thought, that's not my ringtone. That's not an alarm. That's not... Why is this ringing? What is going on? And I recognised the tune. I am not a classical music fan, but I knew it was Satie's Gymnopedia number one because it meant something to me. I'm like a massive Kate Bush fan, and I knew she'd use this piece of music in her 1979 Christmas special as a musical interlude. So I was familiar with that, and I just thought, wow, what is that? This tune just played, and I just stopped crying. It just stopped me in my track. I went, wow, okay, I asked for that. Thank you. That's my sign, that's my reassurance. So I looked through the phone. I was trying to find if there was something that I didn't know I'd set within it that could possibly have triggered that. And to be honest, I didn't even know it had that tune within it. Couldn't find anything. And there seemed to be nothing wrong with the phone. So that was a total mystery. It would have meant nothing to many people. But at that precise second with that tune... to cheer me up when I was really at a low ebb seemed almost miraculous.
Yeah. Did you find if it was on your phone or not? I mean, I can't imagine it would be because it's not the kind of stuff they use as ringtones and things.
It was within the phone. I did find some sort of basic tunes. It certainly wasn't, you know, like, you know, the full piano and orchestra. It was a basic version of it, sort of electronic, bleepy. But I had a real difficult time actually getting into the settings and actually finding where any of these tunes would be. Certainly wasn't set to anything. There were no missed calls, no reminders or alarms or anything. It was, as I say, it was very basic, but nothing like that showed up. So it remained a mystery. And I had like my friend look at it, like, no, I don't know what you're on about. can't explain that one. But that was reassuring. And it kind of happened, as I say, at that liminal time when another couple of things happened, which were, I suppose, slightly strange and quite personal. So I would say the three things happened within a couple of months of each other. I can't remember what came first, to be honest with you, but that one really got me out of a deep, dark hole that I'd fallen into emotionally. Another thing was that I was getting rid of my car. I didn't want to get rid of my car because my dad bought me my car. Mm-hmm. It was well past that I should have given it up, but he'd passed away and I just felt I wanted to keep it going. So I decided, right, I can't continue with this car as it is. And I spoke to my mum and I said, you know, it could be time, but I'm just not sure. And she was like, right, okay, let's go and have a look. So I decided I was going to buy a new car because I'd had enough with the things going wrong.
Yeah.
A brand new car. So I went along and decided I'm going to order it. I'm just going to make the order. Didn't have any that were coming, so it had to wait for it to be manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think to my mum and to my friend, I said, you know, I will know that I've done the right thing and that my dad approves if anywhere on the license plate of this new car there is KT.
Right.
And I didn't actually realise that was quite how unlikely that would be statistically, because the first two letters are the place the car is,
yeah,
I think, it imported into the whatever it is.
Yeah.
And the number's obviously the year. So you basically got three letters at the end that it could possibly be. And it turned out to be TKT when it arrived. And I thought, that's absolutely incredible. The chances of it are so slim. That I took it as a sign from my dad that he approved and that he wasn't going to hold it against me, that I'd gotten rid of the old car.
Yeah. That's so lovely.
It's quite sweet. As a result of that, what I've actually done is I now just have a personalised plate that always has KT.
And why not? Yeah.
Why not? It's another sad Kate Bush reference, but there you go. She hides the KT symbol on all of her records and vinyl somewhere.
Right.
So that's the thing. That's my kind of my go-to, you know, the Kate Bush and the music link, the KT symbol and asking for that to be in my car. Very, very silly, but, you know, can't help it. I'm a fan. The last thing that happened during that spell of weird strangeness, my cat did pass away. Of course he did. And I got another cat and I didn't know what to call him. I'm usually pretty good with these things. I like to choose a name that is appropriate, has some meaning behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And my mind was a total blank. So I wake up one morning and I go, Mika. His name's going to be Mika. Where did that come from? It was almost like when you're waking up, you're half asleep, you're half in a dream, you're half awake. Mika, okay, I need to look that up. So I sometimes have these moments in my dreams where I think, I have to write this down because I'm going to forget in 5 minutes what that was. So I wrote it down and I decided that if it had any sort of meaning that was appropriate to this cat, that would indeed be his name. And Mika, my cat, was a Maine Coon.
Yeah.
So also that big American breed with the tufted ears.
Yes.
I looked it up and I've discovered that Mika is a Native American word meaning wise little raccoon.
Oh.
Which is, where the Maine Coon gets its name from, because they thought they originally may have been a crossbreed with raccoons, which is not possible, but a nice idea.
Oh, that's sweet. Oh, lovely. Yeah.
Yeah, so those three things kind of happened.
Yeah.
As I say, within like a couple of months of each other. And I would say there's probably quite a big gap after that before anything was happening again. And you kind of, I think they're more prone to happening when you are in times of turmoil or stress or crisis. Well, that's how it affects me. That's how it seems to affect me. But there are other things that are just feelings of just knowing stuff which happen. And I actually had a dream. It was probably like a couple of years ago now, which was a really strange one. I started suffering from really bad eczema around my eyes. And my doctor was kind of concerned. She was saying, well, you know, you really can't use steroid cream in that area, because it's, you know, it can cause glaucoma over a period of time and it thins your skin. But yeah, you don't want to be causing yourself glaucoma. So very difficult trying to find some kind of natural remedy, and found that really difficult. So I had a dream. I woke up and I turned to my husband. I had this really vivid dream. It's absolutely, like, didn't feel like a dream. It had that kind of realer than real quality about it. I need to look something up. So I was like, in the dream, it's like, I was talking about my eczema, and this sort of person was talking to me, couldn't see their face, could see like their silhouette as if they were backlit. They had sort of curly hair, and they just said to me in a masculine voice, you need to try aloe and hyssop.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know what hyssop is. Is that a plant? So I wrote it down and looked it up, and it is. It's a remedy for many things. I don't think it will cure eczema, but it was a peculiar word for me to come up with on my own.
Yeah.
I not consciously knew that such a word existed. It's possible I've heard it somewhere and it's crept through my subconscious, but to my knowing, no, I'd never heard of it. And I know what you're going to ask me. You're going to say, so did you try the aloe and hyssop?
Exactly, yes.
Had great difficulty finding hyssop. Could only find it as like a tea. So I did start drinking it. It didn't do any good whatsoever that I could see. So either that was a completely meaningless dream, completely pointless, or I just haven't discovered the way that you're supposed to use the hyssop with the aloe. I have no idea. So yeah, that's pointless. But my doctor managed to find me something that did actually sort the problem out. So hence, I haven't experimented anymore with aloe and hyssop. But you know, if you do ever hear of anybody who has, let me know how they got on.
That's wonderful. Oh, Pamela, that's been great talking to you about those things. Because I say that is how, as you say, at the very beginning, how most people's experiences with whatever we're going to call it, the paranormal, actually are more like, as opposed to, you know, a nice clean ghost comes along and gives you a message or something. It is all these strange little things. How did I know that was going to happen? And what happened there? Where did that come from?
It's the coincidences. So some of them, they're just too powerful to ignore. And you know that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, they don't mean a lot, but it's almost like they're just messages to tell you there's something else out there, or maybe there's someone else out there looking after you, or maybe it's you looking after yourself. Maybe we are just part of this collective consciousness, and there are moments in your life that you're aware you're going to need a bit of extra help, and you're able to somehow tap into that part of the timeline and just help yourself through it. You know, there's so many things have happened that you can't ignore. And a really, really silly thing actually happened. It sounds really daft. You'll probably know that kind of schools have gone back and everything a few weeks ago up here. So we had two new teachers start in our department. And I just once again woke up with this kind of dream knowledge. I went, well, that's really weird. I had a dream that one of the new starts, their mum was a stained glass artist. And in the actual dream, I remember saying, oh, well, they'll know such and such from the studios. And I found myself in that exact situation. And I thought, oh, this is really crazy deja vu. So, you know, I didn't know which of the two new starts it was going to be. But I found myself talking to another teacher about stained glass. And the new start went, oh, my mum's a stained glass artist. And I was like, in the studio? Yeah, in those studios. I went, oh, so she'll know such and such. I was like, oh, yeah, she talks about him all the time. No, but, like, that's so pointless, you know? Yeah. It's an echo from the future, from about, you know, a day ahead.
Yeah.
But there's no reason, no substance, no, you know, what benefit is that to anyone?
Yeah.
Really strange.
Yeah. That's lovely. I like that. I like that term, that echoes from the future. Yes, that sums it up very well. Right, well, I won't keep you any longer either. I said I'd try and keep it to about half an hour of your time.
Sorry.
No, I don't want to impose on your time. Thank you ever so much. That's been really interesting. And I say it's the kind of stories that people can relate to, you know, that happen to people who don't have these cosmic paranormal experiences, if you like.
It's been really nice to chat to you about it.
Thanks ever so much.
Great to talk to you.
Bye.
You too. Bye. Bye.
Let's have another of our creature features. And this time we're looking at one of the more horrid members of the hobgoblin family, the red cap, a creature you really don't want to encounter. The traditional description of a red cap is of a short, thick-set old man with long, prominent teeth, skinny fingers armed with long, talon-like nails, large, fiery red eyes, greasy hair hanging down to his shoulders. He also wears iron boots for stomping on the bones of his victims, carries a pike staff for spearing in his victims, and sports a red cap on his head, which owes its colour to him soaking it in his victim's blood. There is, incidentally, a theory the hideous red-cloaked killer dwarf in the 1973 movie Don't Look Now depicts a female version of a red cap. The only protection against a red cap is to repeat the words of the scripture or to hold up a cross. Then it will utter a dismal yell and vanish in flames, leaving behind a large tooth on the spot where it was last seen. I'm not sure how many teeth red caps have, so presumably after a while they become just gummy people. Anyway, what's intriguing about red caps is they may be a manifestation of an evil spirit associated with a specific location. It was the Romans who developed the idea of the genius loci, or spirit of the place, who would protect and bring good luck to the occupants of a home or villa. The corollary is some places are permeated with such tragedy, horror and bad luck. You have to assume they are cursed by a maleficus spiritus loci, or evil spirit of the place. The UK's best known red cap story centres on the Hermitage Castle on the Scottish borders and one of its original owners, Sir Ranulph de Soles, who was murdered by his servants and tenants in the winter of 1207-1208. known as Evil Lord Souls. He supposedly sold his soul to the devil and in exchange was given a red cap called Robin, although some accounts say he was known as Red Cap Sly, to serve as his familiar and assistant. This Robin Redcap lived in an iron chest secured by three strong padlocks and could only be summoned by Lord Ranulph knocking three times on the chest. The official account of Lord Sewell's death suggests he was killed because he was a cruel landlord. The alternative version said he was a sorcerer who had been sacrificing local children as part of his black magic rituals and was executed by locals to halt his evil ways. As part of his demonic pact, Lord Souls was protected against any injury from rope or steel. This meant he couldn't be killed by swords, daggers, spears or axes. He couldn't also be chained or tied up with ropes, and he couldn't be hanged. But he was not immortal, and on the advice of the famous Borders mystic Thomas the Rhymer, like Sir Ranulph, another real historical character, Lord Souls was bundled up in a sheet of lead, rather like you'd wrap someone in a roll of carpet, carried to a nearby Neolithic stone circle, dropped into a large cauldron over a blazing fire, and boiled to death. The Victorian-era spiritualist and journalist W.T. Stead, who incidentally went down with the Titanic, but not before writing a short story that seemed to forecast his own watery death, sums up Lord Soul's fate neatly in this poem. On a circle of stone they placed the pot, on a circle of stones, but barely nine. They heated it up, red and fiery hot, till the burnished brass did glimmer and shine. They rolled him up in a sheet of lead for a funeral pall. They plunged him into the cauldron red and melted him, lead, bones and all. Redcap is said to still haunt the castle and meet with the shade of his former master every seventh year. So be warned, the next in the seven-year cycle occurs this year, 2020. And that's it. Time to go. Just remains for me to say this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week when we'll have more weird tales. Until then, stay well, stay weird, stay different.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon, which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic and folklore. You can keep in touch with us online at www.weirdtalesradio.com, by email to weirdtales@icloud.com, and on Twitter at Christian Uncut. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Good night.